Chapter 54. That composition of substance and being is not the same as composition of matter and form. Now composition of matter and form is not of the same nature as composition of substance and being, although both result from potentiality and act. First, because matter is not the very substance of a thing, else it would follow that all forms are accidental, as the early natural philosophers maintained, but matter is part of the substance. Secondly, because being itself is the proper act, not of matter, but of the whole substance, for being is the act of that whereof we can say that it is. Now being is said, not of matter but of the whole. Therefore we cannot say of matter that it is, but the substance itself is that which is. Thirdly, because neither is the form being itself, but they are related as things in an order, because form is compared to being as light to enlightening, or whiteness to being white. Also, because being itself is compared as act even to the very form. For in things composed of matter and form, the form is said to be the principle of being, for the reason that it is the complement of substance, whose act being is even as transparency is to the air the principle of being lightsome, in that it makes the air the proper subject of light. Wherefore in things composed of matter and form, neither matter nor form, nor even being itself, can be described as that which is. Yet the form can be described as that whereby it is, or as much as it is the principle of being, but the whole substance is what is, and being is that whereby the substance is called a being. But in intellectual substances, which are not composed of matter and form, as shown above, and wherein the form itself is a subsistent substance, the form is what is, and being is the act whereby it is. Consequently in them there is but one composition of act and potentiality, a composition namely of substance and being, which by some is said to be of what is and being, or of what is and whereby it is. On the other hand in things composed of matter and form there is a twofold composition of act and potentiality, the first, of the substance itself which is composed of matter and form, the second, of the already composite substance, and being, which composition can also be said to be of what is and being, or of what is and whereby it is. It is therefore evident that composition of act and potentiality covers more ground than composition of form and matter. Wherefore matter and form divide a natural substance, while potentiality and act divide being in general. For this reason whatever is consequent upon potentiality and act, as such, is common to created substances, whether material or immaterial, for instance to receive and to be received, to perfect and to be perfected. Whereas whatsoever things are proper to matter and form, as such, for instance to be generated and to be corrupted and so forth, are proper to material substances, and are nowise applicable to created immaterial substances. Chapter 55. That intellectual substances are incorruptible. From the foregoing it is clearly shown that every intellectual substance is incorruptible, for all corruption consists in separation of form from matter. Simple corruption, from separation of the substantial form, relative corruption from separation of an accidental form. Because so long as the form remains, the thing must exist, since by the form the substance is made the proper recipient of being. But where there is not composition of form and matter, there can be no separation of the same, wherefore neither can there be corruption. Now it has been proved, that no intellectual substance is composed of matter and form. Therefore no intellectual substance is corruptible. Moreover, that which belongs to a thing per se, is necessarily in it always and inseparably. Thus roundness is per se in a circle and accidentally in a coin, wherefore it is possible for a coin to be made not round, whereas it is impossible for a circle not to be round. Now, being is a per se consequence of form, for per se means according as it is such, and a thing has being according as it has a form. Hence substances that are not themselves forms, can be deprived of being, in so far as they lose a form, just as a coin is deprived of roundness according as it ceases to be round. Whereas substances that are themselves forms can never be deprived of being. Thus if a substance were a circle, it could never be made not round. Now, it was shown above, that intellectual substances are themselves subsistent forms, therefore they cannot possibly cease to exist, and consequently they are incorruptible. Further, in every corruption potentiality remains, after the removal of act, for a thing is not corrupted into non-being, just as neither is a thing generated from absolute non-being, but in intellectual substances, as we have proved, the act is being itself, while the substance is by way of potentiality. Consequently, if an intellectual substance were corrupted, it will remain after its corruption, which is utterly impossible. Therefore, every intellectual substance is incorruptible. Again, in everything that is corrupted there must be potentiality to non-being. Wherefore, if there be a thing wherein there is not potentiality to non-being, such a thing is not corruptible. Now there is no potentiality to non-being in an intellectual substance. For it is clear from what we have said, that a complete substance is the proper recipient of being. But the proper recipient of an act is compared as potentiality to that act in such a way that it is nowise in potentiality to the opposite. Thus fire is compared to heat in such a way that it is nowise in potentiality to cold. Consequently, neither incorruptible substances is the potentiality to non-being in the complete substance except by reason of the matter. But there is no matter in intellectual substances, for they are complete simple substances. Hence there is no potentiality to non-being in them. Therefore they are incorruptible. Further, in whatsoever things there is composition of potentiality and act, that which hold the place of first potentiality, or of first subject, is incorruptible. Wherefore even incorruptible substances, primary matter, is incorruptible. Now an intellectual substance is that which hold the place of first potentiality and subject, is their complete substance. Therefore their substance is itself incorruptible. But nothing is corruptible except through its substance being corruptible. Therefore all intellectual natures are corruptible. Moreover, whatsoever is corrupted either per se or accidentally. But intellectual substances cannot be corrupted per se, because all corruption is by a contrary. For an agent, since it acts according as it is an actual being, always brings something into actual being by its action. Consequently, if by this same actual being, something is corrupted through ceasing from actual being, this must result from their mutual contrariety, since contraries are things which exclude one another. Hence whatsoever is corrupted per se must either have a contrary, or be composed of contraries. But neither of these can be said of intellectual substances. A sign of this is that in the intellect things even of contrary nature cease to be contraries, for white and black are not contraries in the intellect, since they do not exclude one another. In fact rather do they follow from one another, seeing that by understanding the one we understand the other. Therefore intellectual substances are not corruptible per se. Moreover, neither are they corrupted accidentally, for thus accidents and non-subsistent forms are corrupted. Now it was shown above, that intellectual substances are subsistent. Therefore they are altogether incorruptible. Further, corruption is a kind of change, and change must needs be the term of a movement, as is proved in the physics. Consequently whatsoever is corrupted must be moved. Now it was proved in the physics, that whatsoever is moved is a body. Hence it follows that whatsoever is corrupted is moved, if it be corrupted per se, or else that it is a form or a bodily force dependent on a body, if it be corrupted accidentally. But intellectual substances are neither bodies, nor forces or forms dependent on a body. Therefore they are not corrupted either per se or accidentally, and consequently they are altogether incorruptible. Again, whatsoever is corrupted through being passive to something, since to be corrupted is itself to be passive. Now no intellectual substance can be passive with such a passion as leads to corruption, because to be passive is to be receptive, and that which is received into an intellectual substance must needs be received according to the mode thereof, namely intelligibly. Now that which is thus received into an intellectual substance perfects the intellectual substance and does not corrupt it, since the intelligible is the perfection of the intelligent. Therefore an intelligent substance is incorruptible. Further, just as the sensible is the object of sense, so the intelligible is the object of the intellect. But the sense is not corrupted by a proper corruption except through being excelled by its object. For instance, the sight by very brilliant objects, and the hearing by very loud sounds, and so on. And I say by proper corruption, because the sense is corrupted also accidentally on account of its subject being corrupted. This kind of corruption, however, cannot happen to the intellect, since it is not the act of any body, as depending on the body, as we have proved above. and it is clear that it is not corrupted through being excelled by its object, because he who understands very intelligible things, understands things less intelligible not less but more. Therefore the intellect is nowise corruptible. Moreover, the intelligible is the proper perfection of the intellect, hence the intellect in act and the intelligible in act are one. Accordingly, whatever is applicable to the intelligible, as such, must be applicable to the intellect, as such, since perfection and perfectible belong to the one genus. Now the intelligible, as such, is necessary and incorruptible, for necessary things are perfectly knowable by the intellect, whereas contingent things, as such, are only deficiently knowable, because about them we have not science but opinion, so that the intellect has science about corruptibles in so far as they are incorruptible, that is, according as they are universal. Therefore it follows that the intellect is incorruptible. Again, a thing is perfected according to the mode of its substance. Consequently, we can gather the mode of a thing's substance from the mode of its perfection. Now the intellect is not perfected by movement, but by the fact of its being outside movement, for we are perfected, as regards the intellective soul, by science and prudence, when the movement both of the body and of the soul's passions are subdued, as the philosopher states 7 Physics. Hence the mode of an intelligent substance is that its being is superior to movement, and consequently superior to time, whereas the being of every corruptible thing is subject to movement and time. Therefore it is impossible that an intelligent substance be corruptible. Further, it is impossible for a natural desire to be vain, since nature does nothing vainly. Now every intelligent being naturally desires everlasting being, and to be everlastingly not merely in its species, but also in the individual. This is proved as follows. The natural appetite, in some, results from apprehension. Thus the wolf naturally desires the slaying of the animals on which it feeds, and man naturally desires happiness. In some it results without apprehension from the sole inclination of their natural principles, which inclination is, in some, called the natural appetite. Thus a heavy body desires to be below. In both ways things have a natural desire for being, a sign of which is that not only things devoid of knowledge resist corruptives according to the power of their natural principles, but also those which have knowledge resist the same according to the mode of their knowledge. Consequently those things lacking knowledge in whose principles there is a power of perpetuating their being, so that they remain ever the same as to individual identity, naturally desire to be perpetuated even in their individual identity, whereas those whose principles contain no such power, but only the power of perpetuating their being in the same species, desire also to be perpetuated in this way. Hence we must observe this same difference in those things which have a desire of being, together with knowledge, so that, to wit, those who have no knowledge of being except as now, desire to be as now, but not to be always, because they do not apprehend perpetual being. Yet they desire perpetuity of the species, albeit without knowledge, because the generative power, which conduces to this effect, is a preamble and not a subject of knowledge. Wherefore those things which know and apprehend perpetual being, desire it with a natural desire. Now this applies to all intelligent substances. Therefore all intelligent substances, by their natural appetite, desire to be always, and consequently, it is impossible that they cease to be. Further, whatsoever things begin to be, and cease, have both through the same potentiality, because the same potentiality regards being and not being. Now intelligent substances could not begin to be except through the potentiality of the first agent, since they are not made out of matter that could exist before them, as we have proved. There is no potentiality in respect of their not being, except in the first agent, inasmuch as he is able not to pour being into them. But nothing can be said to be corruptible by reason of this potentiality alone, both because things are said to be necessary and contingent according to a potentiality that is in them, and not according to God's potentiality, as we proved above, because God, the author of nature, does not take from things that which is proper to their respective natures, and it was shown above that perpetual being is a property of intellectual natures, wherefore God will not take this from them. Therefore intellectual substances are in every way incorruptible. Hence in the psalm, "Praise ye the Lord from the heavens," after mentioning together the angels and heavenly bodies, the text continues, "He hath established them for ever and for ages of ages, thus designating the perpetuity of the aforesaid. Dionysius also Div. Num. 4. Says that on account of the rays of the divine goodness the intelligible and intellectual substances subsist, are, and live, and their life never fails nor diminishes, for they are free from the universal corruption, knowing neither generation nor death, and they are raised above restless and ever-flowing change. Chapter 56. In what way it is possible for an intellectual substance to be united to the body. Now since it has been shown that an intellectual substance is neither a body, nor a force dependent on a body, it remains for us to inquire whether an intellectual substance can be united to the body. In the first place, it is clear that an intellectual substance cannot be united to the body by way of a mixture, for things that are mixed together must needs be altered in relation to one another. And this does not happen except in those things whose matter is the same, and which can be active and passive in relation to one another. But intellectual substances have no matter in common with corporeal substances, since they are immaterial, as we have proved above. They cannot be mixed with bodies. Further, things that are mixed, remain not actually but only virtually. After the mixture is made, for were they to remain actually, it would not be a mixture but only an accumulation, wherefore a body formed by a mixture of elements is no one of them. But this cannot possibly happen to intellectual substances, since they are incorruptible, as we have proved above. Therefore an intellectual substance cannot be united to the body by way of a mixture. It is likewise evident that an intellectual substance cannot be united to the body by way of contact, properly so called, for contact is only between bodies, since things are in contact when they come together at their extremes, as the points, lines, or superficies, which are the extremes of bodies. Therefore it is not possible for an intellectual substance to be united to the body by way of contact. Hence it follows that neither by continuity, nor fellowship or connecting tie is it possible for one thing to result from an intellectual substance with the body, for none of these is possible without contact. And yet there is a kind of contact whereby it is possible for an intellectual substance to be united to a body. For natural bodies are mutually alterative when in contact with one another, so that they are united to one another not only as to their quantitative extremes, but also in like manner to qualities or forms, when an alterative impresses its like on the thing altered. And although, if we consider only the quantitative extremes, there is need in all cases for contact to be mutual, nevertheless if we consider action and passion, we shall find certain things to be touching only, and others only touched, since the heavenly bodies touch the elemental bodies in this way, in so far as they alter them, and yet they are not touched by them, since they do not suffer from them. Accordingly if there be any agents which are not in contact by their quantitative extremes, they will be said nevertheless to touch, in so far as they act, in which sense we say that a person who makes us sorrowful touches us. Wherefore it is possible for an intellectual substance to be united to a body by contact, by touching it in this way. For intellectual substances act on bodies and move them, since they are immaterial and more actual. This contact, however, is not quantitative but virtual. Wherefore this contact differs from bodily contact in three ways. First, because by this contact the indivisible can touch the divisible. Now this cannot happen in bodily contact, because nothing but what is indivisible can be touched by a point, whereas an intellectual substance, although indivisible, can touch a divisible quantity, in so far as it acts upon it. For a point is indivisible in one way, and an intellectual substance in another. A point is indivisible as being the term of a quantity, wherefore it has a determined position in a continuous quantity, beyond which it cannot stretch. But an intellectual substance is indivisible, as being outside the genus of quantity, so that no quantitative indivisible is assigned with which it can come into contact. Secondly, because quantitative contact is only in respect of extremes, whereas virtual contact regards the whole thing touched, for it is touched inasmuch as it suffers and is moved. Now this is according as it is in potentiality, and potentiality regards the whole and not the extremes of the whole. Wherefore the whole is touched. Whence follows the third difference, because in quantitative contact which takes place in regard to the extremes, that which touches must be outside that which is touched, and cannot pierce it, since it is hindered by it. Whereas virtual contact, which applies to intellectual substances, since it reaches inwards, makes the touching substance to be within the thing touched, and to penetrate it without hindrance. Accordingly, an intellectual substance can be united to a body by virtual contact. Now things united by contact of this kind are not one simply, for they are one in action and passion, which is not to be one simply, for one is predicated in the same way as being. But to be an agent does not signify being simply. Consequently, neither is to be one in action to be one simply. Now one simply is taken in three ways, either as being indivisible, or as being continuous, or as being logically one. But the one which is indivisible cannot result from an intellectual substance and a body, for the one of this latter kind must needs be composed of the two. Nor again can the one that is continuous, because the parts of the continuous are parts of quantity. It remains therefore for us to inquire whether from an intellectual substance and a body can be formed the one which is one logically. Now from two things that stay there does not result something logically one, except from substantial form and matter, since from subject and accident there does not result one logically, for the idea of man is not the same as the idea of white. Hence it remains for us to inquire whether an intellectual substance can be the substantial form of a body, and to those who consider the question reasonably it would seem that this is impossible, for from two actually existing substances there cannot be made something one, because the act of a thing is that whereby it is distinguished from another. Now an intellectual substance is an actually existing substance, as is clear from what has been said, so likewise is a body. Therefore, seemingly, something one cannot be made from an intellectual substance and a body. Again, form and matter are contained in the same genus, since every genus is divided into act and potentiality. But intellectual substance and body are of different genera. Therefore it does not seem possible that one be the form of the other. Moreover, everything whose being is in matter must be material. Now if an intellectual substance is the form of a body, its being must be in corporeal matter, since the being of the form is not beside the being of the matter. Hence it will follow that an intellectual substance is not immaterial, as above it was proved to be. Again, that which has its being in the body cannot possibly be separated from that body. Now it is proved by philosophers that the intellect is separate from the body, and that it is neither a body nor a power in a body. Therefore an intellectual substance is not the form of a body, for thus its being would be in a body. Further, that which has its being in common with a body, must have its operation in common with a body, because a thing acts inasmuch as it is a being, nor can the active power of a thing surpass its essence, since power results from the essential principles. But if an intellectual substance be the form of a body, its being must be common to it and the body, because from form and matter there results one thing simply, that exists by one being. Consequently an intellectual substance will have its operation in common with the body, and its power will be a power in a body, which has been proved to be impossible. Chapter 57. The opinion of Plato concerning the union of the intellectual soul with the body. Moved by these and like reasons, some have asserted that no intellectual substance can be the form of a body. But since man's very nature seemed to controvert this opinion, in that he appears to be composed of intellectual soul and body, they devised certain solutions so as to save the nature of man. Accordingly, Plato and his school held that the intellectual soul is not united to the body as form to matter, but only as mover to movable, for he said that the soul is in the body as a sailor in a boat. In this way the union of soul and body would only be by virtual contact, of which we have spoken above. But this would seem inadmissible, for according to the contact in question, there does not result one thing simply, as we have proved, whereas from the union of soul and body there results a man. It follows then that a man is not one simply, and neither consequently a being simply, but accidentally. In order to avoid this, Plato said that a man is not a thing composed of soul and body, but that the soul itself using a body, comma, is a man. Thus Peter is not a thing composed of man and clothes, but a man using clothes. But this is shown to be impossible, for animal and man are sensible and natural things. But this would not be the case if the body and its parts were not of the essence of man and animal, and the soul were the whole essence of both, as the aforesaid opinion holds, for the soul is neither a sensible nor a material thing. Consequently, it is impossible for man and animal to be a soul using a body, and not a thing composed of body and soul. Again, it is impossible that there be one operation of things diverse in being. And in speaking of an operation being one, I refer not to that in which the action terminates, but to the manner in which it proceeds from the agent. For many persons rowing one boat make one action on the part of the thing done, which is one, but on the part of the rowers there are many actions, for there are many strokes of the oar, because, since action is consequent upon form and power, it follows that things differing in forms and powers differ in action. Now, though the soul has a proper operation, wherein the body has no share, namely intelligence, there are nevertheless certain operations common to it and the body, such as fear, anger, sensation, and so forth, for these happen by reason of a certain transmutation in a determinate part of the body, which proves that they are operations of the soul and body together. Therefore from the soul and body there must result one thing, and they have not each a distinct being. According to the opinion of Plato this argument may be rebutted, for it is not impossible for mover and moved, though different in being, to have the same act, because the same act belongs to the mover as wherein it is, and to the moved as wherein it is. Wherefore Plato held that the aforesaid operations are common to the soul and body, so that, to wit, they are the soul's as mover, and the body's as moved. But this cannot be, for as the philosopher proves inter de anima, results from our being moved by exterior sensibles. Wherefore a man cannot sense without an exterior sensible, just as a thing cannot be moved without a mover. Consequently the organ of sense is moved and passive in sensing, but this is owing to the external sensible. And that whereby it is passive is the sense, which is proved by the fact that things devoid of sense are not passive to sensibles by the same kind of passion. Therefore sense is the passive power of the organ. Consequently the sensitive soul is not as mover and agent in sensing, but as that whereby the patient is passive, and this cannot have a distinct being from the patient. Therefore the sensitive soul has not a distinct being from the animate body. Further, although movement is the common act of mover and moved, yet it is one operation to cause movement and another to receive movement. Hence we have two predicaments, action and passion. If in sensing the sensitive soul is in the position of agent, and the body in that of patient, the operation of the soul will be other than the operation of the body. Consequently the sensitive soul will have an operation proper to it, and therefore it will have its proper subsistence. Hence when the body is destroyed it will not cease to exist. Therefore sensitive souls even of irrational animals will be immortal, which seems improbable. And yet it is not out of keeping with Plato's opinion. But there will be a place for inquiring into this further on. Moreover, the movable does not derive its species from its mover. Consequently if the soul is not united to the body except as mover to movable, the body and its parts do not take their species from the soul. Wherefore at the soul's departure, the body and its parts will remain of the same species. Yet this is clearly false, for flesh, bone, hands, and like parts, after the soul's departure, are so called only equivocally, since none of these parts retains its proper operation that results from the species. Therefore the soul is not united to the body merely as mover to movable, or as man to his clothes. Further, the movable has not being through its mover, but only movement. Consequently if the soul be united to the body merely as its mover, the body will indeed be moved by the soul, but it will not have being through it. But in the living thing to live is to be. The body would not live through the soul. Again, the movable is neither generated through the mover's application to it nor corrupted by being separated from it, since the movable depends not on the mover for its being, but only in the point of being moved. If then the soul be united to the body merely as its mover, it will follow that neither in the union of soul and body will there be generation, nor corruption in their separation. And thus death, which consists in the separation of soul and body, will not be the corruption of an animal, which is clearly false. Further, every self-mover is such that it is in it to be moved and not to be moved, to move and not to move. Now the soul, according to Plato's opinion, moves the body as a self-mover. Consequently it is in the soul's power to move the body and not to move it. Wherefore if it be united to it merely as mover to movable, it will be in the soul's power to be separated from the body at will, and to be reunited to it at will, which is clearly false. That the soul is united to the body as its proper form, is proved thus. That whereby a thing from being potentially is made an actual being, is its form and act. Now the body is made by the soul an actual being from existing potentially, since to live is the being of a living thing. But the seed before animation is only a living thing in potentiality, and is made an actually living thing by the soul. Therefore the soul is the form of the animated body. Moreover, since both being and operation belong neither to the form alone, nor to the matter alone, but to the composite, being and action are ascribed to two things, one of which is to the other as form to matter, for we say that a man is healthy in body and in health, and that he is knowing in knowledge and in his soul, wherein knowledge is a form of the soul knowing, and health of the healthy body. Now to live and to sense are ascribed to both soul and body, for we are said to live and sense both in soul and body, but by the soul as by the principle of life and sensation. Therefore the soul is the form of the body. Further, the whole sensitive soul has to the whole body the same relation as part to part. Now part is to part in such a way that it is its form and act, for sight is the form and act of the eye. Therefore the soul is the form and act of the body. Dash.